This is Cap Radio special coverage. I'm Randall White. Today we're focusing on protests and police. 2 weeks ago today in Minneapolis, 46-year-old George Floyd was killed while in police custody. In the days that followed, people nationwide have gathered to protest and demonstrate against police killings, which has led to calls for substantive change to institutionalized racism. One of those voices in Sacramento is the Reverend Kevin Ross with Unity of Sacramento. Here he is recently on his Facebook page.
I want you to lean into a place of deep discomfort. That's the starting point for this conversation. There is no way to have this conversation and be comfortable at the same time.
No way to have this conversation and be comfortable at the same time. The Reverend Kevin Ross, or Rev Kev as he's known, setting up to ask people to sound off with the most radical act they're willing to do to make substantive change. The Reverend joins us now live, and I want to start by asking you, Reverend, who did you think would be uncomfortable with your post?
I think everyone is uncomfortable, but particularly white people are uncomfortable with this. It's an obvious thing because we're leaning into something that we have swept under the rug for centuries in our nation. And it's an opportunity for us to get out of the place where we're looking at, ooh, white people are in trouble, but ooh, it's your turn, white people, to lean into a very courageous conversation that will help benefit our whole humanity.
Yeah.
And so everybody's uncomfortable, but I particularly would say individuals who identify as white in this country would be most uncomfortable.
And you said in that lead up that some people might unfriend me. I might lose some followers, and that's okay. Did you, that you know of?
Actually, the reverse effect occurred. I'm very clear about the ideals for which I'm aspiring. The conversation is not about friendship, but it's about freedom. And this is the aspiration of every human on this planet, the ability to be free and to exist freely. And so if I lose some friends in the pursuit of freedom, I will gain something that will serve all of humanity, and that will benefit those that left my life anyway. So I'm okay with that. But no, actually the reverse occurred. I started, individuals were more prepared to have the courageous conversations than I was expecting and started taking actions in a variety of ways.
And people did sound off and have comments, more than 200 at last check that I saw. Were there any, Reverend, that really stood out to you and even stretched your own thinking on what could be possible?
I don't think any stretched what my perception of what could be possible, because I tend to be a tough-minded optimist. And so, but what I did hear from several individuals was this, the question, what can I do specifically? I want to lean in, I want to be engaged, but I don't want to come out and appear to do it wrong. And I don't want to appear as a racist if I say something that is out of turn. And so I heard that, but I'm inviting people to have the ovarian audacity and the testicular fortitude in this moment to trust that your well-intentioned actions in this moment will be well received. I think we can say that we understand how pre-adolescent we've been in this whole discussion on race and how awkward it can be to deal with, you know, addressing issues of race. But I think there's a willingness and a welcomeness from all of us to delve in right now.
Would you say, Reverend, that if your heart is in the right place, that will likely outweigh any bad word choices that you inadvertently used when explaining what you want to do?
I would say that along with having the heart, you know, as Dr. King said, we only need a heart full of love and a soul generated by grace. I think that does apply. I think coming, and that's how I was able to have the conversation in the context of love, in the context of of a love for all of humanity. But I also think that there's a responsibility for individuals to educate themselves. You know, it's like the Congress that, I mean, that just put forth this wonderful, you know, set of reforms, proposals for reform. However, donning the kente cloth, and what it showed me was that while this is well-intentioned for obvious reasons, it also showed me that we have few authentic relationships with the Black community, because they might have been advised that that wasn't necessarily the move to take the knee with the African kente cloth on. It showed more that we have adjacent ships rather than relationships. Uh-huh. It would have been the same thing as if I put a sombrero on to show my support of, you know, my brothers and sisters who are Mexican and their cause for immigration. So I think that it's going to take leaning in a different way, making sure that we're connected in authentic relationships so that we are allowing some guidance to come from those of us who have been engaged in this work for over 400 years. And I do think that having the right mind and heart set to get the healing done is definitely the on-ramp for this work.
You're optimistic in this period that we're in right now that some change could be on the horizon?
I believe the groundswell that we're seeing with people from all walks of life is the evidence. I don't think it's just the outrage for this individual, George Floyd. I think that we are reaching a tipping point in human evolution. And I believe what has occurred with the shelter in place has given us an opportunity in ways like never before to get even more deeply connected to one another's stories and pains and challenges. And I think the George Floyd incident dramatized the relationship that the United States has had with African Americans and people of color, whether it's been conscious or unconscious. It was something that many across the world could relate to. And so I remain a tough-minded optimist. I'm optimistic, but I know in order to make these important changes, we're gonna have to have courage to speak in spaces that we would normally not speak into, and that's Black and white in all of us, and start doing the heavy lifting. I think it's important right now for Blacks to be doing some courageous truth-telling, not with the intention to insult and offend and all of that, but for those individuals who say that you are my brother, it's to fully embrace what my story and my pain is, right? And in so doing, I think that it will encourage whites to be able to then exercise their privilege and power and position in ways, and unprecedented ways. And I believe that this culture of belonging that is occurring thanks to technology and thanks to this most connected generation in human history, I think that's giving us the opportunity. So I'm not Pollyannish about it. I think it's some tough-mindedness that right. needs to go into it, but yeah.
Reverend, in about 15 seconds, can you say it I'm white, I'm listening, what can I do next?
I would invite all of my white brothers and sisters to care, to broaden your neighborhood of concern into the beloved community. Become a part of the beloved community. Outside of my neighborhood and my silo, I want my caring to be tremendously stretched. And then find a way to build relationship, authentic relationship with someone who is Black, and ask that question to an individual who you care about and start there. I think that will be the beginning of a powerful world that works for all of us.
Reverend Kevin Ross with Unity of Sacramento, thank you for taking some time out of your afternoon to be with us today.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be with you.
Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg was on Insight with Beth Ruyak today as the Minneapolis City Council seems to have votes to move against the mayor there and dismantle the police department. Beth asked if that might happen here.
I don't want to even think in those terms about disbanding the police department. I understand the sentiment. I understand the impetus. I understand the defund movement. But maybe there is a bold but more healing conversation to be had that is actually part of the message of the people who are calling for dismantling and defunding.
And he went on to discuss ways local government could make changes.
Why is it automatic that every time someone calls 911, even for an issue that does not involve the threat to life or a criminal activity, do the police and, or in many instances, of course, the fire department respond at huge expense to the taxpayers and, frankly, putting them in positions that are often unsafe and unfair? Our default has been and continues to be police, first responders for everything, risky to them and risky to the public. That's how you have the money conversation here. In a way that actually I hope would have the potential to bring people together and get something done.
Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg there on Insight today. Cap Radio's Sarah Mises-Tan is working on a series of reports focused on examining police reform. Her recent piece is titled, Are Police Becoming Too Militarized and Does It Escalate Conflict? Sarah joins us now. And Sarah, what did you find in your reporting? Were you able to answer that question about the appropriate level of military-style equipment used by SACPD?
Sure. Yeah, it's great to be here. And I think the answer is a little bit tricky to pinpoint, but there were certainly a couple different aspects that I looked at in my piece that do point to different ways that, yes, indeed, Sacramento Police Force is becoming maybe more militarized than they need to be. I think the first thing that we looked at in our piece was the 1033 program, which is a federal program which allows local police departments to acquire used military equipment directly from the Department of Defense. And Sacramento does participate in that. Through that program, Sacramento has received about 300 military weapons, rifles, I guess, through that. I'm not quite sure of the technical name, but guns essentially through that program that they still have in their possession. They've also received an armored tank through that program, which is interesting to note. But then, you know, a lot of advocates mentioned to me, Sarah, you know, the 1033 program is not really the biggest issue that is offering militarization for police forces. It's just that police forces are purchasing militarized equipment right now because they can with general funds. And that is also what we found. Sacramento City Council, right before the coronavirus in early March, actually made a $400,000 purchase of a Bearcat, which is a type of armored vehicle for the police department. And, you know, I did not get any word on if that Bearcat did come out for the recent demonstrations we saw, but it is certainly within their possession.
Yeah. Sarah, we, you know, heard a little bit from the mayor there, and we do have this balance or this tug of war between defunding police or investing more in police training.
Yeah, that is an interesting push and pull. I spoke with Rick Brazil, who's the former Sacramento police chief, and he mentioned as much to me also. He said, if you may have heard it in our piece, but he says it isn't about the hardware that police use, it's about the software. So he says things like training police to de-escalate better is what's needed. It's not necessarily that they may have a big gun or they may have an armored vehicle behind them. But, you know, other organizations like the Anti-Police Terror Project, they mentioned cultural competency training is something that they think officers need, saying that this might help them better address the needs of underserved communities. But, you know, I think we're also seeing just like a general, what's the word that I'm looking for? Maybe a general frustration in the history of policing in this country. Right. I think we're kind of coming to terms with that right now. But, you know, a lot of advocates mentioned to me that the notion of police and the creation of the police force in this country is inherently racist. The origins of police as we know it, it came about as a result of protecting white people and their property. You know, initially they were slave catchers. Initially, the police force was only it was only open to white people to take as a job. So, you know, you look back at the system, there is inherent racism in it that's led to the system that we see in place right now. And so I don't know, as just a journalist who covers this, can training change this? I don't know.
Cap Radio's Sarah Mises-Tan. You can check out her recent piece titled "Are Police Becoming Too Militarized and Does It Escalate Conflict?" It's at capradio.org, and look for her future pieces as well. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks so much, Randall.
And just after the break, we'll speak with a former Sacramento police officer, or I should say a retired Sacramento police officer, who now teaches incoming police recruits at Sac State. And we'll have that just ahead. This is Cap Radio Special Coverage. I'm Randall White. This is Cap Radio Special Coverage. I'm Randall White. And today we're talking about protests and police, and starting with the Reverend Kevin Ross, who gave us his perspective on the current events, and Cap Radio reporter Sarah Mises-Tan on her recent reporting about the militarization of the Sacramento Police Department. One person who knows firsthand what it's like to be a Sacramento police officer and what it's like to be profiled by the police because of his skin color is retired officer Dr. Shelby Moffitt. He's using his knowledge to now teach the next generation of officers training at Sacramento State University. He's the director of Sac State's Law Enforcement Candidate Scholars Program. And welcome, doctor. It's great to have you on this afternoon.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So your experience being profiled by your own department, walk us through one of those encounters, because it happened to you more than one time where you were, I assume, in street clothes, and they didn't immediately know that you were a fellow Sacramento police officer.
Well, I came on the department back in the late 80s, actually 1987, and things have changed, but as far as the stories you hear about young men and women getting pulled over, that hasn't changed. So I was a police officer at the time. I believe it was in the early 90s when this might have taken place. Getting off work somewhere around 1:30 in the morning. After I'm done, I'm driving home. I actually was driving home in a friend's car in a Corvette. And this will be important later in the story. She had or has an Italian last name. So as I'm driving home, two SAC PD officers who did not recognize me, because once I take my uniform off, I'm just a regular person.
Right.
So I look over at them and kind of nod or wave to them. And they looked at me oddly, like, why is he even looking at us? So I was in South Sacramento, I believe, getting ready to get on the freeway to go home. The speed limit was, we were at a stoplight, waiting to go. And as I pulled away, and they looked at me oddly, and I said, well, I'm about to get pulled over. Oh. I'm telling myself this right now.
Uh-huh.
So the speed limit, I believe, was 40 miles an hour on the street. So they pulled in behind me, and I'm assuming if they're doing whatever procedures are correct, they're supposed to be running my license plate, and the license plate came back to an Italian last name. And I said, they probably looked at me and said, these two things do not equate.
Mm-hmm.
So I know my registration was correct and everything else. So I got pulled over. And this is probably about the 10th time, just guesstimate, maybe more than that, maybe 15th time I've been pulled over since I was a police officer. Not because I was doing something, but just pulled over for whatever reason. So this time I decided to, and this is at night, so you know, again, 1:30 in the morning. I pull my badge out this time because I'd gotten to points in. This is getting ridiculous. I get pulled over all the time. So I literally stuck my badge out the window. With all the lights coming on, you can't see anything, flashing lights and so forth. So I'm waving and waving. This has been minutes before they walked up to the car because they're probably running checks. And all I can see through the shadows is someone approaching the driver's side and then stop. And then a few seconds or so later, I hear the door close, the lights turn off, and they made a U-turn and left and went back in the opposite direction. So a number of things could have happened. Maybe they got a call, 911 call. Or maybe if we want to, you know, think what I'm pretty sure happened was they realized, oops, we made a mistake and we need to drive away. So and that was just one of many.
Yeah, there were other times that you had a gun close to your face, right?
Yes, yes. When I was driving up to my mother's, I was living at the time. I was living at home before I moved out. I pulled up to my driveway and thank goodness I had my weapon in my bag. In the wheel well of the vehicle.
Because it could have escalated really quickly if they had seen that.
Because they were looking for a young black male who was 10 years old at the time. They were looking for him for some misdemeanor fight that he had gotten into. So I pull up in the driveway next door, and the deputies, this is in the county of Sacramento. For whatever reason, they, as I go to reach for my bag, I sit up and I've got a shotgun pointed at the left side of my temple and a pistol, the other or whatever, two or three officers. I'm not sure how many it was now, but one of them came around to the passenger side and pointed a weapon, their pistol at me, and said, their paraphrase, don't move.
Wow.
Or you may get injured, something like that.
I want to give you. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. So this is just, many, these are incidents that, like I said, as a police officer, are no different from any citizen that has had these same stories of trauma take place in their life.
We could probably spend the rest of the show with these types of stories, but I want to give you time to talk about how these instances in your own life now play into the training of the next generation of officers.
So one of the things that I look for when I created this program based off my dissertation I wrote for my doctoral dissertation a few years back. And I noticed, as I am I teach at Sac State, of course, in the criminal justice division. So I started asking a lot of questions from my former officer or friends that I knew and said, well, what's the problem with some of the folks that you're recruiting? And they're saying they're not prepared for the rigors of the job because they watch TV and see one thing and realize that it's a lot different from what actually is happening. Uh-huh. I talk to people in the community. They're always telling me that these young men and women are not culturally prepared, as we've kind of heard, cultural competency. One of the things I look for is cultural humility. We don't see a lot of officers that have respect, and we heard the words care. And that's important because, again, it's like my doctors and my or a lawyer. You see on TV, they're always talking about they're going to fight the good fight. But then you meet them in reality, they're like, what can I do next and move on and move on? And this is the same thing with officers. If they don't show compassion for people, people get annoyed and believe that they're, and this is where we lose the lack of trust. So, and at the same time, when I was in the classroom, I noticed that the students were struggling with basic concepts of law enforcement. They are criminal justice majors. So that's where I got the impetus to create the program.
So what do you, in about 30 seconds, what is your biggest challenge in making sure that these recruits go out into the real world and treat everyone fairly?
Well, the main objectives I try to get through to them is using emotional intelligence and social intelligence. When I talk about emotional intelligence, I'm talking about, again, respect and care for the community. Because many of the students or cadets, they seem to have this disconnect between what a criminal looks like. Because as I've taught for many years, that if you ask somebody what a criminal is, the first thing they'll say is a black and brown young male. That's what a criminal is. So if that's in your mindset, you're immediately starting to think these biases are going on.
All right. That's Dr. Shelby Moffitt. He's the director of Sac State's Law Enforcement Candidate Scholars Program. Thank you so much for the work that you do. And that's our special coverage to today. But keep it right here, because in about 5 minutes, I'll be back with an update on how you can get tested to find out if you've been previously exposed to COVID-19. And then tomorrow morning on Insight, Beth Ruyak will talk about wineries reopening. And we're back here again tomorrow at 3:30 with more discussions focused on this moment in U.S. history. This has been CAP Radio special coverage. I'm Randall White.